story altogether. Journalists in the world's largest democracy are caught in a limbo, not just about how to report, but also what to report. Many fear for personal safety, right to report the facts, while others are intimidated, harassed, and even charged under draconian and sedition laws. Some are threatened aggressively. A poignant case is that of Indian journalist Neha Dixit, who revealed a horrifying ordeal while receiving a prestigious International Press Freedom Award.
The last couple of years have been about endless follow-up and legal cases, death threats and rape threats, complete with descriptions of how it should be conducted on my body. They've also been about being held physically hostage by right-wing Hindu fundamentalists while reporting.
Nevertheless, the show goes on while tuning in to watch your favorite primetime, where abuses, yelling, personal attacks, and at times cracking laughter is a routine. According to New York-based hybrid research and journalism organization, The Police Project, 256 reports of violence against journalists in India were recorded from May 2019 till August 2021. Media experts say press freedom has further diminished after the emergence of Hindu nationalist government of the ruling BJP. Recent years have seen a dramatic rise in violence against journalists while they were covering stories on different issues. Social media is also becoming a tool for trolling and threatening not just journalists, but anyone. Many renowned journalists and media personalities have now shifted their platforms in the pursuit of truth and perhaps the other way of the narrative. Rather than appearing on big platforms, they have resorted to social media as an easy tool to put forth their side of the stories.
There is a culture which is not limited to one political party or a particular government, but there's a culture now that has been developed where people who kind of bring out inconvenient truths are questioned.
Experts say after the emergence of BJP in India, there is a sense of polarized environment where journalists find themselves more divided, while many are still confused if it's all about patronizing the popular rather than speaking about the unpopular. But the never-ending or perhaps unwanted debates find more space in Indian media platforms rather than the ones that makes difference. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Europe's vaccine rollout got off to a rocky start at the end of 2020, and now, almost a year later, even distribution across the bloc has not been achieved. In Romania, only 30% of the population is vaccinated. Now it's in the grips of its most deadly wave, with all intensive care beds full and patients being turned away. In Germany, 65% of the population are double jabbed, but some regions are going into lockdown again, and those refusing the jab are being barred from indoor spaces. And in Britain, 67% of the population is double jabbed, and 8 million people have received booster jabs. Nonetheless, with social distancing laws scrapped, numbers are skyrocketing. While some countries are still struggling to give everyone a first and second dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, others are rolling out booster jabs. And the blame game is in full swing. Governments are slamming vaccine hesitancy and lack social distancing, while citizens across Europe are saying they just don't trust the people in charge, the very same leaders who promised poorer nations their fair share of vaccines but have not delivered. The World Health Organization has slammed the likes of Britain and Israel for rolling out booster shots, while the majority of poor countries haven't even vaccinated their most vulnerable.
The clue is in the name, it's a pandemic. And until everybody is vaccinated and everybody is safe, then nobody, theoretically, is safe. And we are seeing what's been called vaccine nationalism, vaccine apartheid. And this is part of Western hegemony, Western hegemonic values, a sense of Western exceptionalism, that poor countries, they can wither on the vine as long as we've got enough vaccines. And it's a case in point that Western countries have far more vaccines in store than what they really need. But there's a reluctance to give out these vaccines, one, because there's a selfishness that is part and parcel of Western society and Western ideology, but also, I think, a sense that Big Pharma wants to start making a profit from these vaccines and is not minded to give them out for free or at cost, as they were to Western countries and Western governments. It's all about power, it's all about imperialism, and it's sowing dragon's teeth in a time of pandemic.
Vaccine apartheid is to no one's benefit. It undermines a global recovery and allows more virulent virus variants to appear. Scientists warn waning immunity from vaccinations could mean many more people across Europe getting sick and dying this winter. Bianca Rahimi, London.
To fish or not to fish, at the center of an escalating row between France and Britain, after France seized one British trawler and fined another for not playing by the new rules.
The UK used to be part of the EU common fisheries policy that allowed all European vessels equal access to these waters. But after Brexit, everything changed. Now both the EU and UK vessels have to have licenses to be able to fish in each other's territorial waters. Not only that, they have to prove that they have done so in the past.
To make things more complicated, the self-governing British territories of Jersey and Guernsey in the Channel Islands issue their own licenses. France accuses the UK of granting a small number of licenses it's entitled to. Britain denies that.
The French have behaved unfairly. You know, it's not within the terms of the trade deal. And if somebody behaves unfairly in a trade deal, you are entitled to take action against them and seek some compensatory measures.
But why is this happening now? In France, it might have something to do with an upcoming election.
There is an election coming up, and therefore President Macron would like to wrap himself in the flag, and particularly if it's an opportunity of actually having a go at the British. But also there's an issue that actually, in terms of a broader EU sense, that actually want to make sure that Britain isn't seen to be benefiting by leaving the Union.
And on this side of the channel, it's all about reminding British voters of the perks of Brexit.
The British Prime Minister, Johnson, is trying to make sure that he is seen to be strong, standing up against the French, and that Brexit is being a success. The fishing industry as a part of the economy is tiny in Britain, but it's a very emotional issue. And of course there, he said he would be standing up and protecting fishing industry, and frankly, he hasn't been doing so.
The French have threatened to prevent British vessels from docking at their ports if the issue isn't resolved soon, against Britain's threats of legal action. For now, though, the two sides seem to have hit the pause button on tit-for-tat measures. Key talks are set for later this week, with experts saying the risk of further escalation remains. Saeed Pariza, Dover, United Kingdom.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-1 7767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
September 2nd, 2021. On the occasion of the National Government Week, President Raisi and the cabinet members met with Imam Khamenei in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniyah during the first days after the formation of the 30th administration.
If there is disagreement, I strongly advise you gentlemen not to discuss it among the people. This is because when a disagreement on economy is discussed in public, it will show its real impact in the business environment. In other words, those imaginary problems will turn into real problems in the market and in the people's economic environment. If there is a disagreement and a problem, they should resolve it in the administration and avoid discussing it with the people. An important point about economy is paying attention to the leading economic sectors. Some sectors play a leading role in the true sense of the word. For example, housing is a leading economic sector. Experts say that if housing gets moving, other sectors will get moving as well. Other leading economic sectors include important industries such as steel, car manufacturing, energy, petrochemicals, and the like.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
When these areas begin to work, they play a leading role. These areas should be set in motion. Coordination between the officials in charge of these areas is very important. Another important economic problem is the issue of monitoring the banking system, specifically printing money and producing cash. According to economic experts, producing cash should be done in proportion with production. If this proportion does not exist, printing money and producing cash should be stopped. Officials should attach great significance to this matter. If this is done properly, it will have many blessings, such as curbing inflation, boosting production, stimulating employment, strengthening the national currency, and other such blessings. This is an important point that, in my opinion, should be insisted on.
Allah
us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Thousands of Palestinians in Israeli prisons have gone on a one-day hunger strike in solidarity with six hunger striking inmates whose health is deteriorating, with two of them not eating for over 100 days now. The six prisoners are protesting against what Israel calls administrative detention, where neither are these individuals charged with a crime, nor are they released. United Nations has said this action by Israel is against international law and illegal. But what does that mean when the words from the UN are not turned into actions to stop this tyranny? I'm going to cross over to Ramallah, start this off by talking to Mona Kennedy. Mona, good to have you with us. Mona, please fill us in on the latest situation. We understand thousands of people have not eaten today, basically, in solidarity with those six. Just fill us in on what's going on.
Well, yes, Marzia, that's from 4,500 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails have refused their meals in the Israeli jails, announcing a one-day hunger strike and a threatening warning that they might repeat this move. This means disobedience. This means challenging the Israeli prison authorities. They are standing with and supporting six Palestinian prisoners. As you have said, those six Palestinian prisoners have been refusing food and on an open-ended hunger strike to protest the illegal administrative detention that allows Israel to keep Palestinians behind bars for indefinite periods of time without charge or trial. We are speaking about Heidi Fasfous, who has been on the hunger strike for 116 days. There is Mukhdad al-Qawasmi, who has been also refusing food on the hunger strike for 109 days. Both had been transferred to Kaplan Hospital. However, the Israeli authorities then returned them to the Israeli prison clinic, and they are refusing to deal with their demands. Experts are saying that the Israeli regime only ends the administrative detention of the hunger strikers when they become on verge of death.
All right, thank you so much for that update out of Ramallah. That's correspondent on the ground there, Mona Kandi. I'd like to introduce my guest to this program and welcome Mick Napier from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Edinburgh. And Charlotte Cates from the Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network out of Madrid.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off with Charlotte. Now, Israel is suffocating Palestinians in every way it can, limiting their movement, their livelihood, their housing, their transport, their ability to complain and protest, and ultimately imprisoning Palestinians at will and killing many of them. What kind of existence is this for Palestinians, and why is it even allowed?
Well, as we can see, that for over 73 years, Palestinians have been fighting back against a brutal form of Zionist colonialism, which was supported and sponsored initially by the British Colonial Project in Palestine and has been since that time by the United States, by Canada, by European countries, and other Western imperialist powers who are doing their utmost to continue to support the colonization of Palestine. Despite that fact, Palestinians have been continuing to resist, to struggle, to fight back, and we see that today behind bars, where there are six Palestinian prisoners putting their very lives and bodies on the line because they love freedom, because they love justice. There is a tremendous imbalance of power in the world, and just as we see the tremendous crimes carried out by Western imperialist powers, the ongoing use of illegal sanctions, unilateral coercive measures to starve countries, invasions and occupations, the unstinting support, funding, and collaboration with the Zionist occupation of Palestine is part and parcel of those crimes, which is why it's so important not just to rely on the fact that that international law holds that Israel's ongoing actions are absolutely criminal and illegal, but to organize and fight back, to build the boycott of Israel, and to do everything that we can to support the Palestinians who continue to resist inside and outside Palestine for the liberation of Palestinian prisoners and for the liberation of all of Palestine, because this is a crime, and Palestinians should not be left alone, and the Palestinian resistance must not be left alone to confront this by themselves. Instead, this is an international crime.
Okay. Well, Charlotte says it's an international crime, Mick, but it is absolutely outrageous, the silence from the so-called international community. After the United Nations actually condemned Israel's administrative detention actions and called it and said it was against international law. But again, we see nothing is done. Why, Mick?
My own government continues to sell sniper rifle parts to the Israeli army. Every government, most of the governments in the EU, are very aware of what Israel's doing. But none of them, well, they divide into three groups. Those who enthusiastically support Israel in its criminality, those who don't care what weapons, and those who, like some of the Scandinavian countries, who really think it's terrible what's happening, but none of them will impose any sanctions on the state of Israel for its endless grotesque crimes against the Palestinians.
I guess the question would be why, Mick. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I guess the question would be why. What's in it for these Western nations, as you talked, even the Scandinavian countries that won't do anything? Why?
I think there's a couple of reasons. One, they defer to power. But the USA, Canada, Britain, and so on, they kind of find what Israel's doing very much their own history. Everything that Israel does to the Palestinians, pretty much, they learned from the United Kingdom during the Mandate. The house demolitions, the shootings, the entire toolbox of terror which Israel used against the Palestinians, detention without trial, mass incarceration, house demolitions, and so on, all of that they learned from the British, and the British had been doing it around the world for a very long time before that. So what Israel's doing, when Ariel Sharon said the only good Arab is a dead Arab, he wasn't being original. He was just repeating something from the U.S. frontier, that the only good Indian is a dead Indian. So the whole idea of settler colonialism, of expelling the indigenous people with huge cruelty, was something that many Americans are quite comfortable with, people among the American elite, and the same in Australia, Canada, and so on, an atrocious history which Israel builds upon. So there's a cultural similarity. But also, I would argue, not everyone agrees, but I would argue that Israel fulfills a very important function for the West in controlling the resources of the Middle East, the markets, but also the hydrocarbons under the soil. Israel smashed Arab nationalism in 67. We all remember, if we're old enough, that Israel joined together with France and Britain when they were dominant powers in the Middle East to invade Egypt in the Suez Crisis. And Israel, I think, is the equivalent of a couple of aircraft carriers for the, you know, for the. If they weren't putting those billions into Israeli militarism, one of their key spokespersons said they would probably need two aircraft carriers stationed permanently in the Eastern Mediterranean. So I think Israel provides a very important service. There's more to it than that, but I think it's a huge strategic asset. And currently, at the moment, Israel, of course, is attacking Syria, overflies Lebanon. It has a history of aggression against every single one of its neighbors. And that attack dog psychology, that attack dog nature of Israel, that's what America's happy to pay for Britain to turn a blind eye to, and really for the Scandinavians sometimes to criticize, but never enough to impose serious sanctions upon Israel.
Well, Charlotte, let's talk about the desperation that these individuals have been brought to, that they think the only thing that they can do right now is sacrificing their lives, that there will be any attention brought to the plight of Palestinians in general and the thousands of Palestinian prisoners being illegally detained specifically.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it goes beyond desperation in many ways. These Palestinian political prisoners, and in fact, the entire Palestinian prisoners movement, has really been and stands every day on the front lines of struggle and confrontation and resistance inside the prisons, because every day they're facing down jailers, they're facing down guards, they're facing down a military court system, they're facing down administrative detention with no arms to fight with except for their bodies, except for their resistance and their steadfastness. And so we've seen throughout decades and decades of struggle that Palestinian prisoners have carried out hunger strikes, much like their colleagues, for example, in Ireland, in South Africa, and elsewhere, because these Palestinian political prisoners represent a political and a resistance leadership that is attempting to be isolated by the Israeli occupation. These Palestinian prisoners are not just desperate, they are also brave and heroic, and they are choosing to put themselves forward and to put themselves in danger, in incredible danger to their lives, in order to take a stand not only for themselves, but for all Palestinians jailed by the Israeli occupation and for an end to administrative detention. And of course, the entire system of colonial imprisonment of Palestinian prisoners. And it's because the Palestinian prisoners movement as a whole and the Palestinian people as a whole stand with the prisoners that we saw all across political lines, all Palestinian prisoners joining in today in this collective action of solidarity and of escalating struggle to support these hunger strikers and to say that these hunger strikers represent the movement as a whole in its demand not only to end administrative detention, to win freedom for these six prisoners, but to bring to an end this entire system of colonial incarceration that is used in an effort to suppress Palestinian resistance and organizing.
Well, Mick, you alluded to basically that Israel has learned from others like England, like the U.S., and of course the main entity which led to its existence of the Israeli regime on Palestinian land is England itself, and it allowed for hunger strikers to die in 1981. Bobby Sands lost his life after starving himself to death because he wanted to be treated as a political prisoner, but former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher ignored him and let him die in prison. Do you think the UK's protege, Tel Aviv, wants to follow suit? Is that what we're looking at right now? Because we know that two of these prisoners now have been on a hunger strike for more than 100 days, and they're not showing any empathy at all.
No, you won't find any empathy. There's merely hatred and contempt. But the Israelis may be cruel and sadistic even something, but they're not stupid. And they in the past have dealt with hunger strikers very intelligently. I don't mean kindly, but intelligently. Because the Israelis know that under certain conditions, hunger strikers can evoke, can stimulate, can really galvanize a mass movement to even higher levels. That was one of Margaret Thatcher's huge mistakes in refusing political status and facing down the hunger strikers. What she scored was a Pyrrhic victory. because Bobby Sands was elected to the Westminster Parliament even as he was dying in the British prison system. And that hunger strike, when we look back upon it from today, was a huge turning point. It changed the electoral map of Northern Ireland and increasingly the whole of Ireland. So the Israelis understand very well when they negotiate with hunger strikers that this is a case, as your other guest has said, of enormous courage, enormous moral capital that these prisoners have. They're already resistance icons before they go into prison in their local community. But when they put their whole bodies against this brutal machine, where Amnesty International says torture is endemic in the Israeli prison system, when these men and women take these steps, then they know that the Israelis become a little bit afraid. And the record shows in the past that although they've pushed it to the limit and inflicted great suffering on the prisoners, at the end of the day, they have been prepared, and they've often reneged on it afterwards. But they've been determined to avoid a crisis by making concessions to the hunger strikers. So the Israelis are telling us something, or they've told us something over the years, that the struggle of hunger strikers is central, is a very powerful motivator for the wider population. And if I would add to that just one thing, during the recent fighting in May, people were amazed, and commenters of every stripe saw how the different sections of the Palestinian people, which the Israelis for decades had tried to split from each other, prevent from communicating, they came together in an unprecedented manner from Gaza, from inside 48, from the West Bank, from East Jerusalem. They welcomed the rockets from Hamas that were fired in defense of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So the hunger strike today, despite the enormous difficulties and fragmentation of the Palestinians because of the lack of a unified leadership, but the hunger strike today takes place on that basis, against that background, that the Palestinians have glimpsed the kind of unity that is possible when they struggle, and the hunger strikers will be making a contribution to that. I say that from the safety of someone not involved in a hunger strike, but the record shows that movements like this, mm-hmm. in struggle after struggle against colonialism, play an absolutely devastating role from the point of view of the occupier.
Well, Charlotte, do you think that, just like apartheid South Africa, that it will take global civil society to ostracize the regime, and this is what needs to be done in order to see a change in dealing with Israel in general?
Fundamentally, on the front lines of the struggle, those who are going to make the most important difference for the future, for the liberation of Palestine, is the Palestinian resistance. The Palestinian resistance inside Palestine, and the Palestinian people and their resistance in organizing out Palestine in exile and diaspora. And of course, at the core of this movement is the Palestinian prisoner struggle. These over 4,500 Palestinians locked behind bars because they continue to represent a true vision of resistance and leadership and organizing for the Palestinian people, but also for Arab movements for justice and for the international social justice movement. These Palestinians who are being locked behind bars are heroes of justice to anyone in the world who cares about justice, freedom, liberation, democracy, equality, and all of the values that any progressive person upholds. However, it's also critical that people around the world act to support Palestinian resistance and organizing by isolating and boycotting the Israeli occupation.
Well, let me just stop you right there, Charlotte. Let me just jump
yes.
in here, because what you're saying is it's also important that people organize around the world. But, I mean, we look at something that's happening right now with these 4,500 prisoners in prison there illegally. At least six kids are also in prison, at least. And we don't hear a lot, of course, in corporate media. So one wonders how the message is going to get out to the majority of people in the world. Of course, there are stations like Press TV and other stations and social media. Is it enough? Your assessment of this?
No, I mean, it's not enough because it's never going to be enough until Palestine is liberated and until these systems of oppression are brought down. But the issue is that you know, global civil society can play a role in boycotting Israel and supporting Palestinian resistance, but this can never happen outside of the victory of the Palestinian resistance itself. And this resistance is stronger and stronger and stronger by the day, and we can see that not just inside the prisons, but as we saw in May of this year, when the resistance was able to force the Israeli occupation to step back. But in terms of supporting that, yes, social media is important. We rely just on the big platforms that are owned by major tech companies that are hand in hand with the Israeli occupation to censor and shut down Palestinian accounts, as we've seen time and time again on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and otherwise. It's also really important that we build our own independent alternative media networks and also work within our communities, in our trade unions, in our churches, in our mosques, in our neighborhood committees, in our local governments, everywhere that we can, in our political parties, to be active and organize and isolate the Israeli occupation and build boycott and put real pressure to sanction the Israeli occupation.
And Nick, your assessment of the resistance itself, because as Charlotte talked about back in May, we see a big difference in the resistance year to year. Your take on your assessment overall on the resistance, and is that the key to the ultimate liberation of the Palestinians?
Well, those of us in solidarity who see ourselves as an extension of the Palestinian freedom struggle can only deliver solidarity to people who are struggling. We are incentivized, we are impressed, we are motivated by the heroism that we see in Palestine. And although things look extremely dark, I offer some words of hope. Only a few weeks ago, we had a Scotland-Israel football game here, an international. And a few days ago, and when the Israeli national anthem was played, the crowd booed. They demonstrated, masses of people, their contempt for Israel. And I see now that FIFA has imposed a fine upon the Scottish Football Association. The efforts that they are going to try to prevent it spreading, the popular feeling against Israel is already there. Every opinion poll shows that Israel's already a polecat state. It's a pariah state in terms of what masses of people think. Now, the efforts that are being undertaken at the moment by the Israelis and their allies to suppress and censor pro-Palestine activism, they're telling us something very loud and clear. They're afraid. Now, how that plays out, when that reaches critical mass, when something like the Block the Boat in San Francisco, in California and India and Scandinavia begins to come together to a sufficient power to help defeat Israel, we don't know. But we know that it's only going one way. It's not going fast enough, but the Israeli crimes are eating at the support that it has around the world.
Okay.
And ultimately, that can play a significant auxiliary role to the Palestinian resistance.
All right, and on that note, I'd like to thank both of you being with us here in Press TV, Nick Napier, Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Edinburgh, and Charlotte Cates from the Samadou and Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network out of Madrid. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. To our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Reporting reveals the households of at least 28 U.S. senators own a combined minimum of $3.7 million and as much as $12.6 million in fossil fuel assets. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, One in Four U.S. Senators Still Hold Fossil Fuel Investments, Even as World Burns. Stay tuned for more. A new report published recently reveals that the members of the U.S. Senate who would have to pass climate legislation are heavily invested in the fossil fuel industry. Sludge reports the households of at least 28 U.S. senators in both the Democratic and Republican caucuses hold a combined minimum of $3.7 million and as much as $12.6 million in fossil fuel investments. According to the report, of the 28 senators, at least 20 hold publicly traded stocks in companies like oil supermajor Chevron, pipeline giant Enterprise Products, or electric utility NextEra that belong to trade associations that are lobbying Congress against taking up a strong legislation to curb polluting emissions. Five U.S. senators are invested in energy funds built around oil and gas assets, and three own non-public stock in private fossil fuel companies. The investments held by the senators, their spouse, jointly, or a dependent, are disclosed to the Senate Office of Public Records in very broad ranges and often buried in hundreds of pages of scanned paper forms, making a more precise count of their total value impossible. At least half a dozen of the senators sit on environment or climate-related committees. The Household of State Energy and Natural Resources Committee Chair Joe Manchin, who has worked incessantly to destroy or dilute climate action in the Build Back Better Act and beyond, has received over $1 million in income from Enner Systems, a coal brokerage firm the senator founded in the 1980s. According to Sludge, Manchin has stripped the Democrats' budget reconciliation bill of major climate programs that would have transitioned coal-fired plants, like the one where the company now run Pakistan holds the prime fuel services contract, while the committee he chairs also added more than $11.3 billion in funding to the bipartisan infrastructure bill that could benefit his family company's niche, waste coal industry. Other Democratic senators whose households are heavily invested in fossil fuels include John Hickenlooper, holds up to $1 million in investments in Chevron and other polluters. Tom Carper owns as much as $274,000 in Chevron and Duke Energy shares. Gary Peters has up to $355,000 in NextEra, DTE Energy, and Pacific Gas and Electric stock in his portfolio. And the wife of Angus King, a Maine independent who caucuses with Democrats, owns up to $50,000 worth of NextEra shares. Earlier this year, Common Dreams reported that six Democratic senators, including Manchin, Chris Coons, Maggie Hassan, Mark Kelly, Kristen Sinema, and John Tester, have received hundreds of thousands of dollars in combined campaign contributions from fossil fuel corporations, some of which have have touted their purported support for climate action over the past decade. The investments are valued at a combined minimum of $3.7 million and a maximum of $12.6 million, and many of them have been held by the lawmakers for at least 3 years. Of the 28 senators, at least 20 hold publicly traded stocks in companies like oil supermajor Chevron, pipeline giant Enterprise Products, or electric utility NextEra that belong to trade associations that are lobbying Congress against taking up a strong legislation to curb polluting emissions. Five senators are invested in energy funds built around oil and gas assets, and three own non-public stock in private fossil fuel companies. The UK research group Influence Map, which analyzes lobbying and communications, this month found that ExxonMobil and Chevron are the top two most negatively influential global companies on Paris-aligned climate policy. Exxon has spent about $4.6 million on political and social issue ads on Facebook so far this year, promoting itself as part of the climate change solution, while its officials hold leadership positions in trade groups including API and U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Chevron's first-ever climate lobbying report this year did not attempt to reckon with its trade association's lobbying against policies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. In total, senators' households have as much as $275,000 invested in ExxonMobil and as much as $370,000 invested in Chevron. Influence Maps analysis found that the most negatively influential lobby groups on emissions policy were API, AFPM, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and the National Mining Association. API's millions spent on Facebook ads this year have recently opposed the Build Back Better Act as anti-industry legislation and have promoted natural gas as a solution. A 2019 report from over a dozen major environmental groups, including 350 and the Center for Biological Diversity, found that leaking methane from gas energy would push the world over the emissions bounds of the Paris Agreement. A conclusion affirmed in May by the International Energy Agency, which backed the winding down by 2040 of oil, gas, and coal power plants. Rick Scott, who won his Florida seat by 0.2% of general election vote in 2018, reported that his spouse holds an investment worth up to $500,000 in AG Energy Credit Appointments Fund IVLP. Announced last year, the fund aimed to raise $1.5 billion to buy distressed debt of oil and gas companies and was affected by Angelo Gordon, a New York-based alternative investment firm that extends credit to companies in a North American oil and gas company. Several senators have disclosed selling off fossil fuel industry investments since their 2019 reports. Ron Wyden's spouse sold up to $50,000 in ExxonMobil on August 21st. Divesting in full from ExxonMobil, as well as from shares in industrial conglomerate General Electric, whose stock is owned by at least five other senators. Dianne Feinstein no longer reports an asset of $1,000 in gas company Antero Midstream that she and her investor spouse held in 2019. Republican John Hoven of North Dakota, the ranking member of the Subcommittee on Energy and a member of the Appropriations Subcommittee on Energy, no longer reports holding several oil assets that
he did in 2019, including stock in Chevron, ExxonMobil, Marathon, and others that had been worth a combined $550,000 maximum. The average age of a senator at the start of the 117th Congress was 64.3 years, according to the Congressional Research Service. The median age of the 28 senators, including in this analysis, is 66 years, topped by Angus King at 77, Joe Manchin and Tom Carper at 74, and John Boozman at 70. Based on average U.S. life expectancy, most of the Senate fossil fuel investors will be dead before the plant reaches 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming above pre-industrial levels, as projected by the UN, to hit between 2030 and 2052, beyond which the most deadly impacts of climate change will begin being felt by those still alive.